Hello, and welcome to Switchblade Sisters, the podcast where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. Every week, here on the podcast, we invite a new female filmmaker, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about their favorite genre film, maybe one that influenced their own work. I'm film critic Katie Walsh, and today we have multi-hyphenate actress, writer, director, producer, she does it all, Sujata Day. Welcome, Sujata.
I'm so excited to be here.
Awesome. We're so excited to have you. So a little bit about Sujata. Performer, creator, writer, director, and Pittsburgh native Sujata Day is known for her starring role as Cece in Issa Rae's The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl and her recurring role as Sarah on three seasons of HBO's Insecure. Sujata is a Sundance Lab Fellow, Sundance Film Festival influencer, and Sundance Collab advisor, as well as serving as a 2019 HBO Visionaries Ambassador. Her short film, Cowboy and Indian, sold to a major studio for series development, and she also directs This Is My Story, a series in which beloved storyteller LeVar Burton narrates real-life personal experiences of everyday racism. Sujata's debut award-winning feature film, Definition Please, is currently touring the film festival circuit. Sujata, so today you have chosen to discuss Brian De Palma's 1972 film, Sisters.
Yes. We just talked about it, but I saw it for the first time this year, earlier this year, and I have told everyone about it and said that they need to watch this movie.
It is a mind bender.
It's a mind bender.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite the experience. I also watched it for the first time this year and then just rewatched it. And it's so crazy and bonkers. I think that's what the word that everyone I see using the word bonkers to describe it. And that's kind of my favorite kind of movie.
It's bonkers, but it also has such a tight, good script. So
yes.
I feel like it's not absurdity for the sake of absurdity. There's so many clues planted from the
yes.
very first scene that on the second watch, like I also watched it a second time this past week, I was like, oh my gosh, that guy is in the audience of Peeping Toms.
Yes. And the thing that I picked up on my rewatch was the cutlery, which I had completely had gone over my head. So she wins the cutlery set on the show, and then that is used in the events of the film for murder and mayhem. So before we get too far into it, I'm going to give a quick spoiler alert. For those of you who haven't seen Sisters, today's episode will contain spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. Like we always say, it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you want to pause this episode and watch it, now is your chance. It is on HBO Max currently. The 1972 psychological slasher Sisters, directed by Brian De Palma, co-written by De Palma and Louisa Rose, was De Palma's first of several shocking, sexually tinged thrillers. Made on a budget of $150,000 and shot on location in Staten Island, Sisters is the story of a French-Canadian model named Danielle, played by Margot Kidder. She meets a man named Philip, Lyle Wilson, on the set of a TV prank show, Peeping Toms, and the two get drunk at dinner afterwards.
Do you like to be alone?
Sometimes, but not tonight.
They head back to her apartment on Staten Island, followed by her creepy ex-husband, Emil.
Does your ex-husband make a habit of standing guard out there?
Why, he's always following me.
In the morning, Philip overhears a hungover Danielle arguing with her sister, Dominique, in French. It's their birthday, and she's come to visit. Danielle sends Philip out to pick up medication, and on the way back, he buys a birthday cake.
What do you want written?
Happy birthday to Danielle. Happy birthday to Dominique and Danielle.
Dominique and Danielle.
Which he presents to her. She's sleeping on the pullout couch. But the woman on the couch is a crazed Dominique, who grabs the knife and stabs Philip to death. He crawls to the window and writes help in blood, which is witnessed by the woman in the apartment across the street, a young journalist named Grace Collier, played by Jennifer Salt. She calls the cops, who are reluctant to respond because she is an anti-police columnist.
Yes, I'll meet you downstairs right away. My name is Grace Collier. Yes, the Grace Collier. I wrote that story. I'm sorry you feel that way, Detective, but I have to write it the way I see it. Sometimes the police are wrong. Look, this is ridiculous. We can't discuss it now. A man is bleeding to death.
Emile enters the apartment to clean up the crime scene, hiding the body in the couch, while Danielle pulls herself together before Grace and the detectives arrive. Danielle plays dumb.
Could somebody have gotten in here without your knowledge?
It would be impossible. I was here all morning.
What about the man that stayed over?
I was quite alone. You see, I'm divorced from my husband, and it's still, but it's very personal, you know.
Grace insists she saw the murder, and as evidence, there were two women in the apartment. She finds the cake with the names of both of the sisters written on it.
Dominique and Danielle, she does have a twin!
But she trips, drops the cake, and the cops leave. Grace pitches the story and hires a private detective, played by the inimitable Charles Durning. Inside the apartment, he determines that the body is in the couch.
He's in the couch!
What?
The body.
What about the body?
What I went up there to look for, remember? The body is in the couch!
And he finds a file on these Canadian conjoined twins, the Blanchion twins, who are Dominique and Danielle. He follows the couch, and Grace goes to visit a journalist who profiled the twins and discovers that they were recently separated and that Dominique died during the separation operation.
After the operation, there'd been some complications.
What sort of complications?
I never did get any official information, so I slipped $20 to one of the suture nurses, and she told me that Dominique Blanchion had died on the operating table.
Grace follows Danielle and Emile to a mental hospital, where Emile convinces the staff that Grace is a new patient.
This man is involved in a murder, and we have got to call the police.
She came to us last night. We're very happy to have her join our family.
She's sedated and put into bed with Danielle, where she has a terrifying hallucination that reveals all about these twins and their crazy life. She learns that Danielle had become pregnant by Emile and that Dominique stabbed her with garden shears in an attempt to end the pregnancy. And the trauma of Dominique's death during the separation caused Danielle to disassociate into her violent Dominique persona whenever she has sex.
Every time I made love to you, Dominique came back and took control of you.
Emile kisses Danielle, the Dominique personality comes out, and she slashes him in the groin with a scalpel. The two collapse on top of Grace, pinning her to the bed in their erotic death embrace. Danielle is arrested for Emile's murder, but Grace is still traumatized, repeating to the detective that she knows nothing about the murder she claims she witnessed.
I'm fine! There's absolutely nothing wrong with me! All I know is there was no body because there was no murder!
Meanwhile, the detective, played by Charles Durning, is still on the case, following the couch to Canada and keeping a close watch on it. So that is Sisters. I know that was a long, complicated synopsis, but it gets across the idea of these twins who are separated, and then it touches on mental health issues like dissociation and trauma and all of this. I mean, it does it in a very like schlocky 1970s way, but it's kind of interesting to see them dealing with these like psychological issues kind of in a frank manner.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, ever since I made my movie, I've been picking out movies that were either early movies of really great filmmakers of today or movies that were made. Like when you said $150,000 budget, I had no idea that that was the budget of the movie.
Yeah, I need to double check that. But in the De Palma doc, he talks about how they only made it on $150,000. So I don't know if that was the final budget, but that was like what he was working with when they started.
But that makes a lot of sense because, that's so great because I'm like, as opposed to, you know, watching a movie of today where a director has $200 million to make this film, for me, that's not super inspiring because I'd just be like, oh, if I had $200 million, I could probably make that movie too. But if I see a filmmaker make this incredible story out of a lower budget, I'm like, that pushes me to write something similar to that.
And your film is totally indie. I mean, you wrote, directed, produced, starred in it. Like, did you guys shoot it in 2 weeks? Is that what I read?
Yeah, we shot it in 2 weeks.
That's wild. So yeah, I mean, you're it's the same kind of like just getting it done, DIY indie filmmaking.
Yeah, yeah. I was reading just a little bit. I didn't go deep into Brian De Palma and his making of Sisters. But Louisa Rose, who you mentioned, his co-screenwriter, I guess went to Sarah Lawrence with him. And so they were friends. And you can tell with the female characters in the film, especially Margot Kidder's character and Grace Collier, I forget the name of the actress.
But Jennifer Salt.
Yeah, Jennifer Salt. So they were roommates. Margot Kidder and Jennifer Salt were roommates.
Oh, and wow, Brian, I didn't know that.
And Brian De Palma was dating Margot Kidder at the time, and he gave them the scripts for Christmas.
Oh, wow. I love that because I did, in the De Palma doc, he talks about how he refers to the cast as his repertory company because it's all people that he worked with before. William Finley was in his first short, and they did a lot of stuff together. And he also plays the Phantom in Phantom of the Paradise. And obviously he knew Jennifer and Margot, and Charles Durning was like a New York theater actor he had worked with before. So it's just like, hey, let me get my pals together. We're going to make a movie. We're going to go to Staten Island. We got $100,000. Like, let's do this. And that, I think, is just such the spirit of indie filmmaking. And it's like, it's fun. It's just go for it. And something really special comes out of that. I know that I'm curious if, like, when you were casting your film, were you reaching out to people that you knew or when you were crewing it, like just saying like, hey, let's go to Pittsburgh and do this?
Yeah, that's exactly what I did. I made the decision to shoot the film. I had already had a shooting script of the film in January of 2019, and that's when I decided to shoot it in June because I had just gotten Destiny intervened, and I had gotten a TV show returned to me by a studio, and so they paid out a huge check for it. And I was like, oh, great. I'm going to put this towards my movie. And as soon as I decided on that, I started texting my friends. I had no auditions. I knew Tesh, who plays Sunny in it. And I texted him and I was like, hey, do you want to play the co-lead in my movie? And he was like, yeah, let me read the script. And it was definitely just people that I knew in the South Asian American Hollywood community that were great actors and have never really had the chance to showcase their abilities. And so everyone was really excited and happy to jump on board and excited to go to Pittsburgh or Greensburg. We actually shot in Greensburg, which is my hometown.
Well, it's also interesting because I know, so Brian De Palma, you know, he's this film school graduate, went to Sarah Lawrence in Columbia, and he is trying to make it in Hollywood. So the film he made right before Sisters was a film with Tom Smothers of the Smothers Brothers and Orson Welles called Get to Know Your Rabbit, which I have not seen. It sounds wacky, but it also sounds like it was a very challenging shoot with Orson Welles, who wouldn't learn his lines. And I think halfway through, Tom Smothers started saying, I don't really know about this. So it was this like nightmarish shoot, and he's got a big budget. And I think it was just such a bad experience that he's like, I'm just going back to New York. I'm going to get my Sarah Lawrence friends and make this movie. And so it's sort of like a reaction to the challenges of Hollywood and, you know, dealing with these bigger systems and these bigger studios, and then just like saying, I'm going to go make something on my own. And that sounds a lot also like your journey in terms of making Definition Please, like on your own terms.
Yeah, yeah. I read about that. Brian De Palma had made like three or four bigger budget films before deciding to do Sisters. And I just thought that was so cool. And I could get into that headspace of it because even me, I've sold a couple TV shows, which is really exciting, but you never see them come to air, or they never shoot the pilot, or they're just in development hell for 2 or 3 years. And then someone lets them go. And so there was a frustration there of like, oh, I have all these scripts that are ready to go. And yes, I sell them, but no one, because of studio notes and executive notes, they never see the light of day. And so that was definitely a push for me to make Definition Please more indie and on my own so that I would have 100% creative control over it, which was really cool and really nice. You know, I loved being the director. I loved having last say over everything. And when the color was done, when the sound was done, it felt good to be like, yeah, that's good. That's it. So it was really nice to just have a piece of work that was completely my own and be able to put it out there.
And I think it allows for a certain type of freedom to experiment. I know, you know, there's so much great split screen in Sisters. Like, I love that about, that's one of my favorite De Palma stylistic tics, the split screen. I think he uses it really well in Sisters, but you could also see how he's able to experiment with things like this and stylistic things like this because he's just doing it on his own. And he ends up making the film and then selling it to American Independent. But it's like your voice and your creativity are completely unbridled. And I felt like you had, in Definition Please, like you had some really interesting stylistic things. Like, what were you playing around with? Like, I love the spelling word moments where that would, which are part of her subjectivity, Monica's experience of the world, like these spelling words, like jump into her head. I mean, did you feel that freedom to just kind of do things that might have otherwise been, you know, seen as a little bit out there?
Oh yeah. I that was all in the script, by the way. So all the spelling words, I was like, oh, it comes out of her head and this is what happens. And so that was all discussed with my DP, Brooks Ludwig. And I was like, oh, this is how I want it to be. And I had just watched Midnight Cowboy and a couple other, you know, AFI movies. And I was like, I just want it to be cool and weird. And, you know, no one's going to tell me not to do that. So, right. So it was really freeing to just be like, okay, this is what I want. And, you know, I feel confident about it. And some people might hate it, but some people might love it. And I knew that at the end of the day, I didn't want to make a movie that was just meh, that was just mediocre, where people are like, oh, it was okay. And that's the response that I've been getting so far. It's been like, oh my God, I love the movie. Or, I didn't really, it's not my thing, which I really appreciate, because when I watch art, when I watch something like Sisters, I love the feeling of, oh my gosh, I love this movie. I love this split screen. I love the unique things that he's doing, how Brian was building tension in those moments. I was like, oh my God, the Grace and the cops, are they going to get to the apartment and find the blood before Emil can get rid of the body? I was just like on the edge of my seat. And also I loved how he played with music, and it did feel sort of like Alfred Hitchcockian music. But I didn't mind that. I just loved that you knew when things were going to get bad because of what the instruments were playing in the background. And I also loved experimenting with music in my movie as well. So that was really fun to do.
Yeah, you used a lot of Indian music, Bollywood type music. I mean, was that something that you had in the script or always wanted to include as well?
Yeah, that was all in the script. I had met this really talented Black female composer, Amanda Jones, at Sundance in, I think, 2019, actually. And I just texted her and I was like, hey, do you want to be the composer for my movie? And she read the script and she immediately started sending me original compositions just after reading the script. Wow. And I was just like, oh yeah, this is amazing. Everything she was giving me was awesome. And she was taking notes really well because she wasn't super familiar with Indian type music, but I would give her very specific songs that I would think of that I was like, oh, this is the Bollywood song that I kind of want it to sound like. And she hired singers out of Bombay and that spoke Hindi and Bengali. So we, together, we kind of wrote the lyrics and my parents would check them if they were in Hindi and I would check them if they were in Bengali. And then I would return them to her and she would just compose beautiful songs out of it. And so that was a really, really fun part of the movie, because I just felt like music is such a big part of Indian culture, but it's not something that is just in your face all the time. It's just, oh, we're just playing like a Bengali song while we're cooking dinner, or it's just playing in the background of the grocery store and we don't notice it in our everyday lives, but it's just there.
Well, we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will talk more about Sisters with Sujata Day.
Does our podcast deep dive into the weirdest Wikipedia pages we can find?
Yes. Do we learn about scam artists, remote islands, horrible mascots, beautiful diseases, and mythical monsters?
Yes, 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 absolutely, and yes. Do we retain any of this knowledge?
Probably not. I'm Emily Heller.
I'm Lisa Hannawalt.
We make art and comedy and TV shows and also the podcast Baby Geniuses. For the past 8 years, we've been trying to learn new things about the world and each other every episode.
But let's be honest, this podcast is mostly about two friends hanging out, shooting the breeze, and making each other laugh. We're horny, we like gardening and horses, and we get real stupid on here.
But like, in a smart way.
Yeah.
Join us every other week on Maximum Fun.
Baby Geniuses, tell us something we don't know.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm Katie Walsh, and we are talking to Sujata Day about Sisters and her film Definition Police. So you had mentioned the music and that it of Sisters and that it sounded kind of Hitchcockian, which was intentional because they actually laid the Psycho track while they were editing as a temp track. And the story goes that Brian De Palma looks at his editor, Paul Hirsch, and he's like, what's Bernard Herrmann doing right now? And they flew in Bernard Herrmann, who composed Psycho and all those great Hitchcock films. And he was really old. And they were like, here, will you compose our score? And apparently they were showing it to him with the temp track, the Psycho temp track, and pieces from Vertigo and Psycho. And he started screaming. He was like, I can't watch it with this on there. Like, stop. So they showed it to him with no sound, and then he just left and recorded the score, which I think is pretty amazing. But it does, you were listening and going, this sounds like Psycho, and especially the stabbing.
Yeah,
and all
these
scenes.
And it's pretty, I mean, it's phenomenal because it works so well. And I totally understand him not wanting to listen to it with his older compositions, you know, because a lot of composers and musicians just want to start from a fresh place and be inspired by what they're seeing on the screen right then. But I loved it. I think it worked really well. And I don't think Brian De Palma ever held back on saying that it was very inspired by Alfred Hitchcock. It was really fun. I think the other thing that I loved about it is that you had mentioned that your mom was yes. laughing and saying that it was hysterical. There's so many funny moments.
Yeah.
And I am mostly in comedy, and I love my films to have an element of comedy as well, even if they're dealing with serious subjects. So I think the best part about Sisters for me was there were just so many moments out of the blue that just made me laugh out loud.
Yeah, and like your film has funny moments and serious moments and sad moments. Like, it has everything in there. I'm sure that was something that you were writing into the script, but was there any sort of process in editing or on set where you kind of had to like punch different tones to get them to work?
I think it was all in the script. And when I was in rehearsal with my actors and I was talking to my actors about how they should play the tone, I just said, this is real life. You know, you get good news and then you're hit with something bad. And you have moments where there are good moments, especially within families, I think, with the relationships were really important in my film. So the key to making the relationships work was to just be in them for real. So how does my character Monica feel about her brother Sonny coming home? How does Jaya, who's played by Anna Kaja, feel about her son coming home? And so I wanted to make sure that all those relationships were very specific, and I did tell them, I told Ritesh and Anna some of the films that Definition Please was inspired by. And it was very, you know, real life grounded, authentic stories like Duplass Brothers, or there were a couple other sibling indie films that I pointed to, like Skeleton Twins and The Savages and You Can Count on Me. And I wanted to just be like, just play the relationships as they are, and it'll come out, you know, whatever happens on screen, it'll just play the reality of it.
And I also, one thing I like about the sort of the trio of Monica, Sunny, and Jaya is like how things can turn on a dime, how you can be having a great time or talking about something emotional, and then suddenly, you know, this has to do with Sonny's mental health issues, but suddenly he's triggered by something, or he's having a panic attack, and it's like, okay, we were having a good time and now it's really bad. And then maybe suddenly it switches right back. And that felt really realistic to me in a way of how things can go when you're in a close-knit family and dealing with trauma and the past and bad memories and whatever it might be that's causing those triggering feelings.
Yeah, yeah. And I pulled all of that from, you know, I had friends growing up with mental illness and it's in my extended family. So in writing his character, I knew that I didn't want to over-exaggerate anything. I wanted it to be very specific to what it was for him, because I know mental illness is different for everybody. And going back to, you know, Brian, he also has depictions of mental illness in his movie, and it works. I mean, it works really well, because I was definitely didn't know that Dominique was dead.
Right.
So I was like, oh, so this is what it's all about, you know? So yeah, for me, I just wanted to portray mental illness in a very realistic, grounded way. And also in terms of how Sunny deals with it himself and how Jaya deals with it by really not dealing with it at all, and how Monica deals with it by essentially just being mean to Sunny and not forgiving him for his mm-hmm. past actions.
Yeah, it's so interesting that, you know, you can see how times have changed, obviously, from 1972, which is almost 40 years or 50 years ago. And the Grace's mom refers to the mental institution as the experimental madhouse. And I was like, oh, my God, I can't believe she called it an experimental madhouse. She's like, they let them walk around. It's like, oh, imagine treating a person with mental illness like they're a human being with rights.
Well, that was also the time when people were going into mental institutions and getting shock therapy, and women were being accused of being hysterical and put in institutions.
Yeah. And I think there were some institutions actually on Staten Island. So I kept thinking about that too, like the real life institutions that were there, and being like, oh, I wonder why he said it here. But it's so interesting when they go to the actual institution and Grace kind of infiltrates and you see some of these quirky people, but it's also recognizable. Maybe quirky is the wrong word to use. Some of the patients, you see some of these patients and you know, it is, their depictions are a little over the top and heightened, but in many ways, it's kind of like, you're like, okay, I that woman has OCD, and you know,
I kind of understood that woman's fear of germs, because that's what we're living in right now.
Did you know that the germs can come through the wires? I never call and I never answer. That's a good way to get sick. Very, very sick. That's how I got so sick. Someone called me on the telephone!
I know. I was laughing so hard, being like, she's like a big mood with the disinfectant spray. We are going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we will talk more sisters.
All All right, Adam, Maximum Fun wants us to record like a promo to tell people that they should listen to The Greatest Generation. You want to do that?
No, I am tired of all the extra work. I just wanted to talk about Star Trek with my friend.
I think it would be good to like try and get some new listeners by appealing to the audiences of other shows. Like this will only take a minute or two. It could be good for us.
We sit down for an hour every week and talk about a Star Trek episode and make a bunch of idiotic fart jokes about it. It's embarrassing. If it got out that we made this show, I think it would make us unemployable.
Adam, I have bad news for you. We have tens of thousands of listeners at MaximumFun.org.
Oh my God. I think I'm going to throw up.
The Greatest Generation, a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. Every Monday on MaximumFun.org.
I'm really going to be sick.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. We are actually talking about Sisters today with Sujata Day, the Brian De Palma film from 1972, Sisters, that is... It's sisters all over the place today. So one thing I did want to mention was I love the character of Grace. I think she feels really modern. I love that she's this anti-police, hard-hitting newspaper journalist, so much so that the police are like, we're not coming to investigate this crime that you've reported. And I think Jennifer Salt is such a great performer. She is like so steely, but vulnerable, but just so determined and so ambitious. And I feel like that kind of woman is not necessarily seen in a lot of movies from this era. But even like, you know, we don't see women as fully realized and sort of ambitious and interesting as Grace all the time in film. And yeah. I just find her so refreshing.
That was a big part of when I am looking for older movies to watch for classic films. I'm like, oh, are there lead characters who are women? And that was one of the things that I noticed while watching the film that, oh, wow, she's written really well. And I wonder how much Louisa Rose had in terms of writing that character where, you know, it's a very ambitious, career-forward woman who's not afraid of people. But I thought it was really interesting metaphor for ambitious women where we're going to put you in your place. And at the end of the film, you know, she does a whole 360 and she's back at home and, you know, isn't believing anything that she saw. So I thought it was done really well in terms of just being real. And I noticed that in The Exorcist as well. When I was watching The Exorcist and I just thought it was all about, you know, this girl and her head spinning around before I went in to watch the film. And it was about this woman who's a single mom. And I was like, what? Because you, like you said, you don't see characters like this in movies from that time period.
I love Ellen Burstyn and The Exorcist. And it really is about sort of I think the subtext of that film is kind of about like the crisis of divorced parents, or not the crisis, but you know, like that was happening more often in the early 70s. And I think there was like some anxiety around single moms and broken families and like what's going to happen to the kids. And so I think that she's so great in that and so realistic and so flawed, but not in a villainous way, just like in a very realistic way. And she's just trying to do her best. And her daughter is possessed by a demon.
Yeah. Just happens to be, you know, everyday stuff.
You know,
everyday
Grace
stuff.
Is just a hard-hitting journalist. And she happens to see a woman having a dissociative episode, stabbing a man. But also, like, it feels really modern because what she's concerned about is that the cops are racist because Philip is black and that they're not investigating the murder because of his race. And I'm like, damn, Grace is on top of it. She is
super...
Yeah,
that felt really timely, that part of it. I was like, yeah, yeah. I also loved her interaction with her mother in the car, which felt very much like a stereotypical Indian mom being like, why aren't you married? Why are you worried about your work so much? You should have kids by now. So that was also really humorous to watch.
Yeah. And it's a sort of efficient way to kind of color in her character a little bit more to have her mom point out these, you know, what she perceives as shortcomings in her life. And you understand more about who Grace is and that she's super career driven. And that's not a bad thing. And that she, you know, wants to pursue this career and tell these hard-hitting stories and do the best at her job that she can do. I feel like as a woman who's very career oriented, I sometimes wonder, if, you know, it's like, I don't see myself represented all the time in a way that's like positive. You know, you don't want to be like the bitch on wheels that is like in all of the films that are about career women.
Yeah.
Like Katherine Heigl.
Yeah.
Sorry to Katherine Heigl. We love her. But, you know, her characters are always like, she's a cold, uptight woman who can't find a man because she loves her job too much.
Yeah. I also, when you come out of the film, you also realize that Grace is the hero of the movie. You know, she's making so many decisions herself. I think a lot of the time when we watch movies from that time period, things are just happening to the women with them not having any say in it. And Grace is really pushing the narrative forward in terms of, you know, okay, calling the cops, going to the apartment, you know, going to the reporters, finding out about the Blanchion twins and their past. And so she's really driving the narrative, which is exciting to watch because you're on that journey with her and you want her to succeed.
Yeah. And it's kind of interesting because the first sort of 20 or so minutes of the film, you think it's going to be Danielle's story. And then suddenly it flips to Grace's story, which is a kind of fun switcheroo, kind of a psycho-ish kind of move a little bit where you switch main characters kind of early on. So speaking of Grace and the type of female characters that we like to see, female heroines that we like to see, you gave Monica a happy ending. I wasn't really sure what was going to happen there in Definition Please. Maybe we don't want to spoil it. I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but maybe we should.
No, we can talk about it. Okay. We can talk about it. Yeah.
But, you know, just like the journey that she goes on, she's stuck. It's kind of a coming of age story. She's dealing with family things. But then you start to realize that, like, maybe she's using the family things as an excuse for her own fear of failure, perhaps.
Yeah, I don't know if you noticed, but the first word that Monica spells that she wins the whole spelling bee with is the definition for that word is like a late bloomer coming of age. So I just wanted to, you know, if you weren't aware of the spelling of the word, I was just like, okay, well, this is going to set up the rest of the movie. And that'll be one of the themes. And so you watch Monica, who is flawed. I definitely wanted to show a flawed female heroine. And you watch her kind of go through life and she's stuck, which I believe that a lot of us have been in that position and we don't know what we want to do with our lives. We don't know what the next step's going to be, especially even now in COVID, where there's so much upheaval and, you know, a bunch of us are at home with our parents and just hanging out and working from home. And when are we going to get out of that? So I feel like that's relevant to Monica's journey where she doesn't know what she's doing. And you think maybe it's outside influences that are keeping her, but then you realize that it's really just herself who doesn't want to move forward or change. And she needed that push from someone who loves her. And so I really wanted to, you know, focus on that sibling relationship and try to see the roller coaster of it and see if they can repair it. And I wanted to leave off on a bit of hope. You know, it's not like everything is fixed at the end of the movie. You know, there's still issues and problems, but just like any real life family situation, nothing's going to get fixed right away. So I think there's just like, oh, she made the decision to move on to the next part of her life, but there's still a lot of growing to do amongst all of the characters.
Yeah, I think in any character story, like you want to see some movement, some growth. You don't, you know, so I think that, you know, it doesn't have to be everything's fixed, but just like we're taking a step forward. Because I think that, like you said right now, I mean, I think a lot of us are in that position of being like, what's the next move? We're all kind of stuck and just thinking about it. And waiting for a moment when we actually can take some action. So it's a good thing to kind of ruminate on, I guess, although we might be feeling a little bit frustrated about the limitations that we're in right now. We're going to wrap up in a couple minutes, but is there anything else about Sisters that you just have to get off your chest?
I mean, there's so many moments that I love. I loved the split screen. I thought that was so effective in terms of building suspense. I loved the opening of the movie, the peeping Toms. I was like, first of all, you open on this scene and you don't know exactly what it is. And it's Philip watching a supposedly blind Danielle starting to undress. And you're like, what's going on? And then it pulls out and it shows that it's the Peeping Tom's game show.
It's Peeping Tom's, starring Ted Kraft. And now, here's Ted.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Peeping Tom's, New York's newest and grooviest game.
Which sets up the rest of the movie, because I feel like we were voyeurs into all these people's lives, and a lot of the shots were from window to window, or from inside the van to watching the couch leaving onto the truck. So in terms of setting up the film with that first scene, I thought that was really great. And explored the rest of the themes of the movie really well, which was just like us peering into these lives, and Brian using really great shots to illustrate that.
Yeah, voyeurism is such a huge theme, I think, in Hitchcock's work and in Psycho and also in De Palma's work. And it is like so perfect that he's saying, we're going to open this on a television show called Peeping Toms. Yeah. It's almost like, I don't even know if he's aware of it, but it's like a little wink, like, I'm Brian De Palma and we're going to talk about voyeurism.
Exactly. I just thought that was so perfect.
Well, Sujata, it's been so fun talking to you about Sisters on Switchblade Sisters. Can you tell us where people can see Definition, please? Or if there's any, is it going to be coming out soon?
Yeah, so we're still on the festival circuit right now. The next couple festivals we're doing is Seattle Asian and Colorado Dragon Film Festivals. And we are talking to a couple distributors and streamers in terms of distribution. So hopefully, fingers crossed, it will be coming out to the general public pretty soon.
Well, definitely keep an eye out for Definition, please. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This has been so fun. And we got Sisters on Switchblade Sisters.
that's a tongue twister.
I know. Well, thank you so much for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you would like to tell us what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group too. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
The body is in the couch!
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.